I'm Owen Bennett-Jones, in for Dick Gordon, and this is The Connection. Has your granny become a drug smuggler? Already, coach loads of elderly citizens have become lawbreakers by going to Canada to buy their drugs. The governor of Illinois sympathises with them. He's setting up an online system offering citizens a way to buy cheaper medicines from outside the United States, not only from Canada, but also from Europe. And that's because a prescription drug, in some cases made by the same company, in the same factory, typically costs more in the US than it does in Europe or Canada. Well, the FDA says the grannies and the governor are acting illegally, but it hasn't enforced the law, perhaps because it fears the reaction should it do so. So should America look abroad for cheaper prescription drugs? Have you gone online to buy drugs? And if so, have you thought about the safety implications? Is there a risk? And if so, is it worth it? The number to call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's begin with some thoughts on this initiative in Illinois. I have on the line Illinois Congressman Rahm Emanuel. Thanks for joining us, and I know you've been working on this issue with the governor there. Can you tell us more about this decision to make drugs available online from Canada and from Europe as well?
Well, it was a decision based on the fact that, continually senior citizens are faced with skyrocketing prices on average that are going up 20 to 18% a year with no material difference in the product. And we know for a fact that a lot of these drugs are somewhere between 40 to 60% cheaper in both Canada and Europe, and they're the same name brand drugs. You take like a Lipitor that's made in Ireland, exported worldwide, is sometimes 40% more expensive in the United States than it is in Canada, Ireland, England, France, or Germany. In Europe, they have what's called parallel trading. If you're in England, you can buy medications your doctor prescribes in either Germany, France, or Spain, or Amsterdam, for that matter, where you find it cheaper. And it's giving Americans that access to the marketplace. Second, and I'll just finish one point, is, last week or 2 weeks ago, the pharmaceutical industry announced that it was going to do a lot of research and development in India. It's taking advantage of cheaper labor costs in India. Now, the marketplace and the principles of the free market are accessible to the pharmaceutical industry, yet they don't want to expand or extend those same principles of competition and price competition to the consumer. And that's just wrong.
You're a congressman, and you are facilitating criminal activity. That's odd, isn't it?
Well, first of all, I think when I can save people's lives who are going without medication, cutting pills in half, skipping a month or two, I'm actually helping people save lives. And, in fact, a million senior citizens and others every year for the last 10 years have gone over the border to Canada to get cheaper medication, cheaper priced medication, same name brand drugs. States like Wisconsin, Minnesota, New Hampshire, North Dakota have set up similar websites. The city of Springfield, Massachusetts, and now Boston are doing similar things. Now, I don't think everybody there is trying to break the law. Everybody's trying to facilitate getting people 40 to 50% savings.
But they are breaking the law, though. You don't deny that.
No, I think that the FDA's pretty ambiguous. I mean, I've seen non-committal on this issue. I've seen the FDA on record, in print, say, yes, we know this going on. We don't either prosecute or prosecute these cases, and we don't follow them up because they know there's not a safety risk, and they don't want to challenge this because people are trying to literally get the medications, any life-saving medications.
Okay, well, we're going to talk to the FDA in just a moment. We'll hear their point of view then. Let me just put this question to you. It
sure.
is an important one. Can you be 100% sure, without any chance of error, that the drugs that people will buy through your website are what they say they are and are safe?
Well, we know this, that unless you set something like this up, you're never going to know. And this is, and setting up a system so people have an organized way of doing it is a lot safer than letting a million senior citizens a year go on their own and not knowing it. And two, let me challenge you. Can you tell me every senior citizen that cuts their medication in half or skips their medication or denies themselves food or electricity so they can't buy their medication is safer and healthier? When you answer that question, I'll fully answer yours.
Oh, no, I don't answer questions. I just ask them.
And, well, I try to do the Talmudic method periodically.
No, but, I mean, this is an important issue. You are setting up a system here.
My question is, you can say 1,000% guarantee. Well, first of all, nobody guarantees like that. Second of all, I think the system today is failing. I'm trying to improve on a failed system that is locking people in to higher prices, many times forcing them to skip the medications they're doing. And if the prescription drug legislation we passed in Congress over a year ago had dealt with the most fundamental issue of price and affordability, there'd be no case for reimportation because it skipped that and was more worried about the pharmaceutical industry's bottom line and the HMO and insurance industry's bottom line. It left the senior citizens on the literally on the side of the road.
Congressman Rahm Emanuel, thank you very much for joining us. Let's get the FDA take on this now. William Hubbard is Associate Commissioner of the FDA. He's on the line. What's your reaction to what you just heard?
Well, these drugs will clearly be illegal, but the most important thing is that FDA cannot give them any stamp of safety. And if only 1% of the people that bought these drugs got a bad drug, you could end up with 2 million injuries by Americans, and that would be catastrophic to allow unregulated, unproven drugs to be imported into the United States.
Yeah, but lots of people in Europe take these drugs, and to be honest, they all look fine.
Well, there are lots of sites out there that would sell these drugs that aren't in Europe and pretend to be, or aren't in Canada and pretend to be. And whenever you have drugs that come in an unregulated way, there's going to be incentive for manufacturers to cut costs, pharmacists to sell an expired drug, or otherwise do nefarious things. And as I said, if only a tiny, tiny percentage of those are bad drugs, a lot of people are going to get injured.
In that case, why are you not enforcing the rules? Why are you allowing illegal activity to carry on and not do anything about it?
Well, we've certainly sued vigorously commercial operations that attempt to profit from these drugs. We've tried to reason with public officials, but they clearly want to move ahead with these. In fact, what they're trying to do is import price controls. And if that's what they want to do, they should merely legislate price controls on American drugs, and then FDA gets out of the way because we know they're American-made, FDA-regulated drugs.
Now, hold on. You say American-made. Some of the drugs you approve of will be made abroad, I'm sure.
Absolutely, and they're made under FDA supervision and imported legally into the United States, where we know that they're made. If they're made in Ireland, it's the same as making them in New Jersey because FDA inspectors are there to make sure they're made properly.
Exactly. So is it not your responsibility to go to the factories where these drugs that the Illinois congressman's talking about are made to make sure it's safe and in that way facilitate the American people to get cheaper drugs?
I understand, but many of the drugs that would be imported under this sort of program will not be that same drug. They will be made in India or Pakistan or Malaysia or the other places where we see them made. They're coming in now, and they will come in more if these programs are encouraged.
I don't get that. What's the evidence for that? I mean, these drugs are approved by the EU, and as I say, in the European Union, there are not people. This is not an issue that there are false drugs going around.
That is the theory.
No, it's the practice.
But the reality is we monitor the mails, we open these packages and see a lot of really bad stuff. And in fact, in terms of the EU, as Mr. Emanuel said, they have parallel trade there. So that means any drug sold in the UK can come from the UK, Germany, or France, which may be fine, but can also come from Latvia or Estonia, which perhaps have less sophisticated regulatory systems.
Have you any evidence of counterfeit drugs being on the market in
Absolutely.
Western Europe?
Yes. In fact, counterfeiting of drugs is endemic around the world, particularly in Eastern Europe. The United States is relatively free of counterfeit drugs, but we're very concerned that programs like this will give an entree to the counterfeiters to our market.
All right, tell us what you're going to do about the Illinois initiative then. We heard the congressman there. He's defying the law. He's defying you. Are you going to clobber him?
Well, as I said, we've tried to reason with public officials. We have not thus far threatened a lawsuit. It may come down at some point to asking a federal judge to referee this matter because you do have a fundamental clash of values here between public officials seeking cheaper drugs and FDA trying to protect people against unsafe drugs.
Do you not have a just slight suspicion that some Americans are being ripped off?
Absolutely. Some Americans are paying prices they cannot afford, and we understand that. But FDA has no authority over drug prices. And Congress could have authority over drug prices. So, again, I would encourage Mr. Emanuel to price control the American drugs that FDA can assure the safety of, as opposed to importing price controls from another country where we cannot regulate the drugs.
William Hubbard, thank you very much for joining us. And to discuss this further, I'm joined now by Jerry Avorn, Associate Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School and the author of a new book on these issues. It's called Powerful Medicines, The Benefits, Risks and Costs of Prescription Drugs. So bang on for the issue that we're currently discussing. You heard the two versions there, the congressman from Illinois and the FDA. What's your take?
Well, I remember the days when FDA's job was to protect the health of the American people and not to protect the bottom line of the drug industry, and I would like for us to go back to those days. There's really very little, that, if nothing, that Mr. Hubbard said that makes any sense from a clinical or a pharmacological or a policy point of view. There is virtually no evidence that there has been harm, and FDA for almost 100 years now has been regulating what substances Americans put into their bodies. We've been doing it domestically since about 1906, and it is completely within the realm of what a willing FDA could do to say, here are some agencies in Canada or England or other Western European countries, for starters, that we are going to authorize as providing safe and authentic medications to the American people, just like they do for American manufacturers.
Did you just use the word virtually, no evidence?
The only evidence, and it's actually pretty embarrassingly scanty, is that periodically, as Mr. Hubbard said, they will go down to a dock somewhere and open packages from Bangladesh or another developing country that are purported to contain drugs and find things in them that they said is not something you could buy at your local drugstore. That's not really a rigorous assessment of what's going on, and there's a lot of Canadian pharmacies that do a very good job with this.
Are there more counterfeit drugs on the market in Canada and Europe than there are in the United States?
There is absolutely no evidence of that.
Are the safety standards here tighter?
No. We in America sometimes, this must seem very odd to a Brit, we in America sometimes think that we have the only advanced healthcare system in the world. And in fact, as you know, in Western Europe and Canada and Japan and Australia and New Zealand, they have very fine healthcare systems and people are not dropping dead because of poisonous drugs.
Let's just pin down the price difference to get an idea of what we're talking about. I looked at a website for Lipitor. What does Lipitor do?
It is a cholesterol-lowering drug. It works very well.
Right. Now then, in Canada, New Zealand, $1.86 per pill. In the United States, this is the cheapest I could find in the United States, $3.07. It's a big difference.
It's a very, very big difference, and that's because the United States is the only industrialized country left that does not have some kind of a negotiated price for its medications.
Just before we go to the break, explain that. How do other systems work it? How do they get the cheaper prices?
It varies country to country, but essentially all of them will sit down with the manufacturer and look at the credentials for the drug in terms of its clinical trial data, and there will be a negotiation which the country will say, we are paying for these medications for our citizens. This is what we think this ought to go for in light of all the other drugs in its class. And that seems to work for every industrialized country in the world except for ours.
So it's price control?
Yes. They like to call it negotiated price, but it effectively comes down to price controls. And yet the companies manage to make profits in each of these countries. If they didn't, they would simply not sell their drugs there. No one's putting a gun to their heads to sell drugs in Canada or England or Germany. They apparently feel it's still worth their while in terms of the profit they're making.
Right. Is it governments that do this or insurance companies?
Yeah, then again, that varies country to country. In many instances, it's government, sometimes national, sometimes provincial. Sometimes there'll be large nonprofit health insurers that do the same thing.
But in the U.S., it's just market-driven. There's no control at all on the price.
That's right.
Okay, well, we'll come back and talk more about this in a moment. We're talking this hour about the cost of prescription drugs. Why are they so much more expensive in the United States than they are in Canada and Europe? Have you bought medications off the internet to save money? Have you ever experienced buying a counterfeit prescription drug? Would you feel safe if the drugs you took came from the UK or Latvia? 1-800-423-8255. That's the number to call. I'm Owen Bennett-Jones. You're listening to The Connection on NPR. I'm Owen Bennett-Jones in for Dick Gordon, and this is The Connection. We're talking about the cost of prescription drugs in the US and Europe and Canada, and my guest in the studio, Jerry Avorn, professor at the Harvard Medical School and author of Powerful Medicines, The Benefits, Risks and Costs of Prescription Drugs. If you want to call us to join in this conversation, the number 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Now, waiting patiently on the line, I have Wanda Mobius. She's a spokesperson for the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America. Thanks for sticking with us. And can you answer this question? If you get a drug made by the same company in the same factory to exactly the same specification, how come it costs more in America than it does anywhere else?
Well, earlier, Dr. Avorn was talking about price controls in European and Asian countries, and that's exactly what's going on. He did kind of exaggerate when he said that nobody was putting a gun to your head and making them sell these drugs in foreign countries. Actually, what is going on is that if you fail to sell in a certain market, a country can take over the patent of a drug and start making it themselves. Now, no research and development company is going to allow a foreign country to take over its patent, so it has never got to that point. But there are, you know, forces that are making companies sell at prices that don't reflect the value of what it costs to actually make these life-saving pills.
Let's be quite specific about this. Are you saying you sell drugs to Western Europe and Canada at a loss?
I don't know if it's at a loss. I do know that it's not at a price that reflects the cost of what it took to manufacture that pill.
It just depends how you add up the cost, doesn't it? It would obviously reflect the marginal cost.
Well, yeah, I'm sure there are marginal costs.
Yeah, which would be met by the prices you're charging in Western Europe. I mean, you have to be able to say, to pursue that argument, that you're making a loss in Western Europe. You can't say that, can you?
I don't know. I do know that the prices are unfairly low and that the American patient has to pay a higher cost to make up the difference. We call it the free rider effect, and I know it's something that Congress is looking at and for the first time addressed in the Australia Free Trade Act just a few months ago.
Tell you what, Wanda, stay with us. We'll be talking about this more. I just want to bring in someone else's. We've just got him for another 5 minutes, so let's just go to Richard Morais now, who writes for Forbes magazine. He's actually a senior editor there, and I know you've been looking into what goes on inside of Europe, Richard. Can you tell us about the sort of grey market that exists in trading prescription drugs within Europe?
Sure. You have me for 10 minutes.
Lovely.
This is an area and a subject that is so important, but there's also a tremendous amount of myths being created. Your speakers earlier, I think, addressed nicely the safety issue, which if you go visit these parallel traders in Britain, for example, you will find that they are licensed, that when they get a license, they have to say what drug they are going to be importing from what countries. They have to pay for an FDA-type official to be on their premise at all time to oversee what they're doing. They have to be able, if drugs have to be called back because there's something wrong with them, they have to be able to track them. So I think the safety issue is a bit of a straw dog, and I do not understand why the FDA keeps on making that one. The fact that by forcing it underground as it is now, you have sort of and over the internet through anonymous sources, that is how it invites these counterfeits to come into the system. But regarding the profits, I have a lot of sympathy for what the spokesman from the pharmacy says, and also because the fact is that it does take studies have shown about $900 million to come to it. You know, it takes 15 years of approval and research to create a drug from the lab to the market. And those are the successful ones. There are, you know, hundreds of millions of tests that, of course, don't materialize in anything efficacious.
Right. So that's the R&D issue, and we will discuss that fully in a moment. Tell me now just about the middlemen, because I think it's an important point you were making in your article.
A very important point. I mean, one of the myths, as Congressman Emanuel said, is that, you know, that the consumers benefit from parallel trade in the UK. Well, the fact is that they don't. In Britain, the retail price of a drug is stipulated by the national government. And so when a parallel trader working with a pharmaceutical distributor and a pharmacy find a cheaper source in Southern Europe for the drug, they capture 80% of the spread between the low-cost European, you know, Southern European price and the retail price in Britain.
There are
some mechanisms that the British government have to claw back some of that profit, but they get a fraction of what the profit is actually there. And there's an LSE, a London School of Economics study, that shows quite clearly that the majority of the profit is captured by parallel traders and the intermediaries, and not to the benefit of the end consumers.
Right. So it's not the patients who get the savings from the trading of drugs within the EU. It's the basically the guys who buy it cheap in Greece and sell it onto a pharmacy more expensively in the UK.
That's correct.
Now, also tell us, to give us some idea of the figures involved, because they're quite fantastic. You were writing about the HIV/AIDS treatments made available in Africa by GlaxoSmithKline for 33 cents. And in Europe or the US, it would be $10. Now, that is a huge difference. And a lot of the drugs destined for Africa are never getting there because these arbitrage traders are whipping them, basically.
Right. Well, that is an example of what's called illegal arbitrage, because the rules are quite clear that drugs that have been, you know, that are practically, you know, being given away at cost by the drug manufacturers to Africa, to poor countries, have to stay there, and that it is illegal for these drugs to even to get up to be imported into the EU. The parallel trade that is legal in the European Union is only within the borders of the European Union, where there is sufficient discrepancy in prices already to make it a very profitable business for the middlemen. But that example, I mean, that's why the FDA scenario, as I don't understand, it's like there's certain things that are beyond politicians. And if you have these huge price differentials and the risk-reward, I mean, the fact is that the risk-reward of trading in combivir from Africa and illegally, you know, smuggling into the United States is far less than smuggling heroin. So guess what? Organized crime moves into it.
Richard Moraes, thanks very much for joining us today. Let's take our first call today. It's Joe from Lake Clear, New York. Joe.
Hi. I have a problem with the argument that the FDA has to prevent the importation of pharmaceuticals because it poses some safety risks to the American consumer. The USDA and the FDA import medical devices and foods every day. They have a rigorous registration and inspection process to make sure that these items are safe. Why don't they just apply those processes to the pharmaceutical manufacturers abroad who want to import to the U.S.? If they don't meet those criteria, they can't come in.
Yeah, Wanda Mobius, it doesn't seem beyond the wit of man for the FDA to check the sources of these drugs, does it?
You know, I'd like to just jump in quickly because I think we're kind of talking about two different things. You know, when people address Canadian drugs, they very rightly think that these drugs are coming from Canada. But what hasn't been told is the number of countries that are now importing drugs into Canada for the sole purpose of being resold to American consumers. And we're seeing exports from countries like Romania, Pakistan, and Bulgaria into Canada, again, not for sale to Canadians, but for the sole purpose of being resold to Americans. That's increasing between 100 and 300% year over year. Now, why are those drugs being brought into that country? Well, clearly it's to meet the American, you know, demand. Now, those drugs, people think they're getting a Canadian-approved drug, a Canadian-inspected drug, and that is simply not the case.
Well, it is not even inspected by Canada. You're sure of that?
Well, Health Canada, like the FDA, is only responsible for drugs that are being brought into that country for its citizens. The FDA is responsible for the drugs that are being brought into this country for our citizens. If the drug is being brought into the country for the sole purpose of being resold to another country's citizens, it doesn't have jurisdiction over it. It's basically treating Canada as a giant post office.
Sure. Okay. In that case, can you tell us that and, some of these drugs that have come from developing countries through Canada to the United States are counterfeit?
Who knows? That's the problem. We are talking about playing Russian roulette with your prescription drugs. There's no way to know for sure, 100%, that these drugs are safe, that they're subpotent or superpotent, or they don't have any of the effective medicines at all. There have been stories about people buying prescription drugs and finding out that maybe it was subjected to a very high temperature, degrading the efficacy of the pill. There's been examples just in Maryland of the FDA, you know, seizing a package of insulin that was improperly chilled. And
Wanda, in medicine, we don't make decisions based on there once was a person who had a bad thing happen to them. That's not the way FDA regulates drugs. That shouldn't be the way we make health policy. If the FDA and the industry were serious about this, they would be doing a systematic study and say, in a sampled way, here is how many instances we found of this problem. I think it's really kind of an insult to the intelligence of the American people for both the industry and for Mr. Hubbard of FDA to be using these scare tactics that, in fact, are not based on actual evidence but are only only based on fear-mongering, which is not something the American public wants to hear.
I'm sorry that you interrupted me. What I was trying to say is that there are better solutions for people who need prescription drug assistance. People aren't going to Canada because they want Canadian drugs. People are going to Canada because they need help paying for their prescription. Some people need help paying for their prescription drugs. And there are better ways to help people. There are patient assistance programs up and running. They've been up and running in this country for the last 50 years. And one of the most successful is one called www.helpingpatients.org. Last year, we gave away free or discounted drugs to 6.2 million Americans.
Can I break in, Wanda, because we're just shifting slightly from this crucial issue of whether there is a risk of people buying counterfeit drugs. And I just want to bring in a caller on this, Dr. John Abramson, and I think you're at Harvard Medical School, aren't you?
A clinical instructor at Harvard Medical School.
Yeah, what's your view on this?
And I've done research. I have a book coming out, Overdosed America, The Broken Promise of American Medicine. There's a clear-cut answer to this debate. I spoke with Jarena Volk, who's the spokesperson for Health Canada, equivalent to our FDA, on January 28th, and asked her point blank, has there ever been an instance of a counterfeit drug coming from a registered Canadian pharmacy to the United States? And her answer was a simple no. So the concerns that Wanda raises, I think, may have some validity for people buying imported drugs from non-registered pharmacies and illicit websites. That's a concern. But I think that each of the I think the pharmaceutical industry is representing its own interests when it spreads this fear that counterfeit drugs will come from Canadian pharmacies to the United States.
Wanda? Hi, Wanda.
Hello?
Do you want to respond
to
that point?
It's not just a matter of counterfeit drugs, though. It's also drugs that get damaged in the delivery system. It's about drugs that get degraded when exposed to high temperatures. And that's the one thing that we need to do a better job. We as the industry need to do a better job of explaining the risks. Earlier, Dr. Avorn used kind of inflammatory language about people not dropping dead. You know, that is the worst-case scenario. I mean, I don't know if he's an MD or a PhD, but I don't think anyone practices. Okay, then I don't think anyone should practice medicine with the hope that, you know, people won't just drop dead from taking a pill.
Are you saying, Wanda, that if you were in Canada, you would not trust a drug in a registered Canadian pharmacy?
No, I'd say quite the opposite. That's not the point. The point is the bait and switch that's happening when people think they're ordering from a real Canadian pharmacy, which I don't think anyone disputes the safety of the Canadian drug supply for Canadians. It's when you open up that system and inject millions more, hundreds of millions of more people in, forcing a system to support people it's not built to support, and making it a lot more vulnerable to bad actors.
Dr. Abramson, just allow you come back on that before you go.
Yes, there was an instance of insulin coming from Canada that did get above the optimal temperature, though it needs to be there for 28 days before the drug degrades. But there was a study that was federally funded in 1997 that looked at insulin that was shipped within the United States and found many problems. The industry lobbied against temperature sensors in the drugs that were shipped within the United States. So I think it's a bit disingenuous to say one example of insulin coming from Canada got too warm, so we shouldn't do it, when we don't address the drugs that are bought for full price and shipped within the United States. I think our goal needs to be how to get the most effective drugs to the American people most efficiently. And an important issue that we're not addressing is, for example, Lipitor for the elderly going to Canada. How many of the elderly really need Lipitor? There is not evidence from randomized clinical studies that Lipitor improves the health of elderly people at risk of heart disease who do not already have heart disease, and there's good evidence from the PROSPER study that it increases the risk of cancer.
That's another point altogether, though. So thank you very much, Dr. Abramson. Yeah, Professor Avon, you want to make a point?
I think if we're thinking about risks to the public health, we need to consider the most important risk in terms of medications, and especially poorer Americans, and that is the risk that they're not going to be able to take their own drugs that they need that their doctors prescribe to them. And we've done a number of studies in which we've seen that people, particularly the elderly, are not taking the medicines their doctors prescribe because they can't afford them. And this has been shown in a number of other settings in the medical literature. That is the risk to the public health, and that is a much more important risk because it's real and documented and happens every day than the imagined... Wanda, you have to not interrupt me. That is a much more important risk than a theoretical scare tactic risk that has not been documented. And if these indigent care programs that the industry is so proud of were working so well, we wouldn't have old people getting on buses and trying to figure out the internet to get their drugs from other countries. We failed them.
Wanda.
I couldn't agree more that the real problem is making sure that people have access to the prescription drugs that they need. And that's why our industry has set up a program where more, you know, six times more people are getting free and discounted drugs from our programs than they are going to Canada to get illegal, risky drugs. You know, absolutely, no one in America should have to make the decision between electricity and drugs or food and drugs. If they're in that position, they should be contacting not only the patient assistance programs, their physicians, they should be contacting their members of Congress. Let's have an honest debate about how to bring rational thought back to the healthcare process instead of having a false debate that doesn't really offer a long-term solution for healthcare costs.
But basically, Wanda, you're saying the government, you know, should subsidize people who can't afford these things. But when you look at the figures of the cost of healthcare in America, I mean, I've got this thing here from the World Health Organization. I mean, it's quite stunning, really. United States, per capita health spending per year, $4,500. UK, with exactly the same life expectancy, in fact, no, slightly better life expectancy, $1,700. So you're asking, really, the government to subsidize an extremely expensive system, aren't you?
Actually, I'm not asking the government to subsidize. I'm asking that all Americans take a look at the process and come to some sort of consensus about the best way to address it. I mean, if it's a market solution, that's probably the best. I mean, studies have shown that market solutions tend to keep costs down while ensuring access to the drugs that they need. I'm not asking for the government to subsidize. I'm asking for us to have an honest intellectual debate about how we can improve access to insurance, because it's people who don't have insurance who are going to Canada. It's not, you know, people like you and me and the doctor who have insurance going to Canada.
We can't have globalization work only for some Americans. It can't be that it works for Nike to make their shoes in the third world and for the drug companies to manufacture their drugs wherever it's cheapest, and then to say to the citizens, you cannot participate in the global economy. It can't work that way.
Okay, both stay with us. We'll be talking more after the break. Cheaper prescription drugs. Is it possible to make medications in the U.S. more affordable? If so, how can it be done? And we'll be talking particularly about this issue of whether other countries are freeloading and getting research and development paid for them, really, by the American people. The number to call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You're listening to The Connection on NPR. I'm Owen Bennett-Jones in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection, and we're talking about opening the door to European drugs for American consumers. My guests, Jerry Avorn, professor at Harvard Medical School and the author of Powerful Medicines, and Wanda Mobius of the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America. The number to call is 1-800-423-8255. And Paula from Raleigh, North Carolina.
Hello.
Hi.
Last year I was in Spain, and I caught a cold near the end of my trip and went to the drugstore and asked for something, and they gave me an over-the-counter medication, which someone had recommended. And I hadn't finished the cold. When I came back, my medicine had run out, so I went to my drugstore, got the same kind of thing, same everything, but the side effects here were much more severe, and I stopped taking it. And in talking to a friend, she had the same experience with a different drug for a different problem. She got it in Spain, and the side effects were so bad with our drugs here in America that we both stopped taking our medications. I don't know if they put more of the stuff in the drugs and makes it cost more. I don't know what's going on.
Let me put that to the doctor.
All right.
Well, there's always a risk in trying to make conclusions based on instances that happen to small numbers of people, which is why we can't really take seriously these claims that we're hearing from industry about imaginary possibilities. No, it is not the case that we put more stuff into drugs here. If it really was the same substance, then it's hard to explain why that would happen. We do tend to have very good quality control over drugs in the U.S.
Marilyn from Newton, Massachusetts.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm calling to find out why, given the fact that I know that from Dr. Avorn's talk at another program, that the smallest amount of money, that the smallest percentage of funds that drug companies get goes into R&D, why is it that, I mean, very small compared to marketing, why should the American consumer be subsidizing consumers and the rest of the world. I mean, if it's Russian roulette to import drugs, why did the administration pass a bill for senior citizens that says that the government can't negotiate prices with drug companies? It makes no sense to me at all. It seems really terribly unfair and, in fact, cruel.
Let's just go to Wanda Mobius on this and ask you to explain one of the central arguments used by the drugs industry, which is that prices are high because there needs to be money coming in for R&D.
I'm a little confused by the last caller, because in 2003, pharma member companies alone spent $33 billion on research and development, much more than the $25.3 billion the entire industry combined, which is including members that don't belong or companies that don't belong to pharma, spent on all drug promotion. And people also need to keep in mind, of that $25.3 billion, a lot of that, $16 billion of that amount, is free samples. So to say that we spend more on marketing and advertising than we do on research and development is simply false. It's part of one of the very destructive myths that policy advocates have been putting out there to kind of undercut the value of the industry. Our drugs save people from far more painful and debilitating diseases and procedures. It allows people to prevent harm to health and to live really healthy lives. But what you're seeing is definitely an effort to undercut the value of the research and development, and that's simply wrong.
But are the Europeans and Canadians, in your view, freeloading?
Well, you know, we've talked about, you know, the free rider effect, if you will, of what happens when foreign countries put price controls in. And we do think it's unfair that American patients have to make up the research and development costs of drugs because foreign countries get to put price controls on. It's totally unfair.
Right.
Like I said, we're very pleased that in the last trade agreement, the Australia Free Trade Act, price equity for prescription drugs was finally addressed. It was the first time in the history of the United States that happened.
Let me just put this to the professor, because it seems to be one of the central arguments that
basically
they're not too expensive here, they're too cheap in Europe, and it's the Americans who end up paying for the R&D, which the Europeans get the benefit of.
Right, that every other country's got it wrong, and we're the only ones who have gotten it right. Some of those policy myths that Wanda refers to are being disseminated by the United States government. The Department of Health and Human Services, which is a fairly careful body and certainly not a bunch of pinkos, has done a study in just the last year or two in which they looked at, based on filings from the drug companies themselves, what fraction of revenues go to what purposes. And the numbers are 30% to research, promotion, and administration, 20% to profits, and about 13% to R&D. And so if we're worried that there's freeloading going on, I think the freeloading is happening on the part of the companies, which have been the most profitable industry in the United States for each year going back several decades. There's an awful lot of money that is, and they're certainly in their rights to earn a profit on good drugs, but we have a very inefficient way. If we're only getting 13% of our drug spend plowed back into R&D, and a lot of that R&D is not to come up with breakthrough products. A lot of that is to come up with, our company needs a cholesterol drug because we don't have one, even though there's already 10 on the market.
Yeah, but if U.S. prices go down, surely R&D will be affected.
No, that's not right, and here's why. If you look at the economics of the drug industry, there is a tremendous tax benefit for research and development costs. In fact, there are R&D tax credits that are very lucrative that go back to the drug companies. So if the companies needed to pull in their belts a little bit, it would almost certainly be in areas other than R&D, because that is one of the most cost-effective ways for them to spend money if they're going to survive.
Fair point, Wanda.
You know, if I can just jump in, we were talking about, you know, how numbers are attributed and sliced and diced. And, you know, I know this for a fact, $33 billion spent on research and development. And when people pull out the number of promotional costs, they often lump in administrative costs. They lump in the IT support, the communications and procurement, property taxes, corporate functions. I mean, there are a lot of different elements that go into making these numbers seem much larger than they are. And I just want to reassure people that we are spending far more on research and development than practically any other sector of industry. and it's because the future cures come from research and development, and our member companies are looking, you know, 5, 10, 15 years down the road and not just at today.
Let me ask you to respond directly, though, to the point that the professor made, that if prices went down, R&D would not be greatly affected because it's a very tax-efficient way of spending your money.
I don't even know how to address that. I mean, we're talking about a hypothesis that thankfully will never be tested. Why would we want less research and development?
Well, no, this is your central argument, that if the prices come down, you won't be able to do the R&D. But we've just heard the professor say that he doesn't think that would be badly affected because various tax systems and tax benefits and so on mean that you have an interest in keeping the R&D going.
Well, I don't know where he's getting that from. It's simply, you know, I'm just not familiar with that.
Well, I am. I was on an Office for Technology Assessment panel a number of years ago where we looked at these numbers very, very carefully. And in writing Powerful Medicines, I was able to go back into some SEC data and Health and Human Services data that bears out my point. But the other issue that hasn't come up that we need to recognize about R&D is that an enormous amount of the important scientific breakthroughs that go to contribute to the discovery of new drugs happens with federally funded research going on in university settings that may be funded by the National Institutes of Health or private philanthropies. And these are university docs working on federal grants, making very important discoveries that then lead to drugs, and then it is the companies that will patent the drug. But the pivotal breakthroughs are often made with taxpayer-supported research.
Let's take another call. We've got Robert in Yarmouthport, Massachusetts.
Hi.
Hi.
A number of months ago, my doctor put me on Lipitor, and a couple of weeks after I started taking Lipitor, I took a vacation to France. Well, the Lipitor seemed rather expensive to me, so while I was over there, I was passing a drugstore, and I thought, well, I'll just go in and see what the story is. So I walked in a drugstore, and I asked them. I said, "This." I had my prescription bottle with me, and I said, "This is what I'm taking. Do you have this?" And they said, "Yes." And they walked over to the counter, and he said, "Here, this is it." It was right over the counter. The same. It was under a different name, but it was the same active ingredient. And I was paying $2.64 a tablet at the time in the United States. It cost me in France $1.15 a tablet. When I got back to the United States, I called a Canadian pharmacy just to see what they were charging for it, and it was $1.74. So I'm not that impressed with the Canadian drug benefits. But anyway, I was a little concerned about taking the drug because I didn't know, you know, I didn't know what controls were on it and all that. But I went ahead. I started it when I finished my other prescription that I'd bought in the United States, and I used it for 2 months. My doctor called me back in for another blood test. I took the blood test. My cholesterol level, which was what I was taking this drug for, had dropped precipitously. So apparently the drug that I bought in France was just fine.
You broke the law.
I broke the law. It's an over-the-counter drug in France.
Yeah, but you're not allowed to buy drugs abroad.
Ah, well, then they better come get me, because what happened was I had a friend over in France, and when I discovered how good it was, how well it was working, I had him buy me about a 6 month supply of the stuff, and he sent it.
Study on, you'll end up in jail.
there aren't enough jail cells.
I'm dead because I can't afford to buy the other.
There aren't enough jail cells in the country to imprison all the people that are going to be doing this, and I think we need to have a different way of looking at it.
Well, Wanda, let me put that point to you. It is such a widespread phenomenon apparently now in the United States. Do you feel that the system has really broken down?
No, I don't. I think the system is fine. I think what we need to do is address ways to improve insurance coverage, and I'm very surprised that the doctor doesn't agree with me. Like I said, people who have insurance coverage aren't going to Canada. People who have quality drug coverage can buy their drugs from the local pharmacist where they have face-to-face interaction with the front line of prescription drug dispensing.
That's not really true either, Wanda, because more and more people with insurance are getting hit with very big copays or deductibles, and every year that the burden, even with people who have coverage, is growing, and they're going to be going to Canada soon, too.
Let's take another call. TJ from Cape Cod, Massachusetts.
Yes, I'm calling in because I worked in the pharmaceutical industry in the 80s, and unfortunately I was in a position that I knew of some unscrupulous practices, specifically the company that I work for, a major pharmaceutical company, manufactured a major antibiotic in its U.S. plant for $15 a gram, approximately. They shipped that product to Canada at the sister plant, in which some excipient agents were added and tumbled in a blender for, you know, a few minutes, sent back to the United States at $1,500 declared value, at the border. And that was the basis for establishing what it costs for that product. Now, I don't know that all pharmaceutical companies would do that, but it certainly was something that I felt was very unscrupulous because the products and processes could have been done right there in the new U.S. plant.
Thanks very much, TJ. Let me just, before we close this, raise one other issue. The TV advertising, it's the only country on earth that I've ever seen where you have this huge amount of advertising for drugs. Wonder, I mean, you know, coming as an outsider to it, I don't know, it seems to me the doctor should decide what drug you take, not the patient.
Absolutely.
Going.
Absolutely. The physician is the ultimate gatekeeper of what drugs are dispensed to patients. We just want to make sure that patients understand that the symptoms that they may have may be signs of a problem, and to let them know that if they have a series of symptoms, just to ask the question. I think healthcare is moving towards a more empowered, informed patient. Health news coverage is on the rise. You can't turn the corner without hearing, you know, the latest update in a clinical trial and things like that. And an informed patient is an empowered patient. I think that's good health care.
How much do you spend on them, the TV ads? Do you know?
Well, I mean, it doesn't break out just the television ads alone. Overall, in marketing, including the free drugs that are given out and everything else, it's about $25 billion a year. But it's we don't break out.
$25
billion? The commercials themselves, all the direct-to-consumer advertising is now running about $3 billion a year. And I don't think it's empowering a patient to convince them that the drug their doctor put them on is not the right drug, but the drug that they saw the commercial about is the right drug. It's not about empowering. It's about pushing product. And all of this would be all right if it weren't for the fact that we're talking about people's health here. This is not about buying computers overseas or buying cars. This is about people's medicines that they need to stay alive.
And you just don't want patients challenging your great wisdom as a
well,
doctor.
Well, I'd be happy for there to be public information. I just don't want it to be about a particular product that they think they need when they often don't.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you to all our guests today. Jerry Avorn, professor at the Harvard Medical School and author of Powerful Medicines, The Benefits, Risks and Costs of Prescription Drugs. Thanks also to Wanda Mobius, who's the spokesperson for the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America. And earlier, we were joined by the Illinois Congressman, Rahm Emanuel, William Hubbard from the FDA. He's an associate commissioner there. And by Richard Moraes, who's the senior editor for Forbes magazine. Our senior producer, Tara Murphy. I'm Owen Bennett-Jones. This is The Connection.